Hello and welcome to the ABC News Powerhouse Politics Podcast. I'm ABC Congressional Correspondent Mary Bruce.
And I'm ABC's National Political Reporter Mary Alice Parks.
Your ears do not deceive you. We are not John Carl and Rick Klein. Those slackers are somewhere on a beach, hanging out with frosty beverages, watching all of this maddening breaking news go by.
I know, the girls episode.
We're taking over. Two Marys.
Taking over.
Well, you know, all jokes aside, though, it has been quite a remarkable week. It has been a violent, emotional, exhausting week. I mean, I know we say this about a lot of weeks, but I think
you used the word raw. That's
raw.
Right.
It has been very raw. In the wake of the violence in Charlottesville, the country now we've seen is grappling with some pretty big, tremendous questions. We're grappling with a complicated history, some very big questions about race in America, questions about what the president stands for, what he thinks this nation stands for. His response to the violence in Virginia that we've seen over the last several days has been nothing short of explosive. I think we use a lot of adjectives in this business these days to describe politics, and this is a week where I think all of them have really applied.
Right, real questions about leadership in this country.
Absolutely. Even members of his own party are telling him now that his own words are dividing the nation, not helping it heal. And I think, let's do just a quick review here, right? It was just actually 1 week ago today when white nationalists marched through Charlottesville. Those images that everyone has seen now, those powerful images of the torches on the lawn of the University of Virginia campus in Charlottesville. It, of course, led to the violent protest that left one woman, a counter-protester, dead. Heather Heyer was mowed down by a white supremacist. And then you flash forward to today, Mary Alice, when we're hearing some pretty powerful words from her own mother about how the president handled this.
Right. Her mother gave a powerful interview on Good Morning America and said that the president's aides did try to call her earlier this week, but during her daughter's funeral. She said plainly... Yeah, she said plainly that she has not, still, and will not speak to the president. But she had advice for him. She said, think, Mr. President, before you speak. Let's listen to that.
I'm not talking to the president now. I'm sorry.
What
he said about my child. And it's not that I saw somebody else's tweets about him. I saw an actual clip of him at a press conference equating the protesters, like Ms. Heyer, with the KKK and the white supremacists.
You know, Mary, you were there for that press conference on Tuesday that really just seemed to go off the rails. And now infamous press conference for this president. You know, what was it like being in the room?
It was surreal. I think surreal is the word. It started off combative, but that's not unusual for these days, some of the way that these press conferences start off. And then you're right, it quickly went completely off the rails. And we've seen this before from the president, when he feels that he is under attack, when he feels that he is being asked to defend a position of his that maybe some think was inappropriate. Remember, at the time he had taken, you know, he'd come out and initially spoken out against the violence on many sides. And then it took him 48 hours after the violence to finally call out the hate groups by name. And then there we were in the gold lavished lobby of Trump Tower, and the president was once again doubling down. 3 days after this, he was back to his initial much criticized response, blaming both sides.
And you got a question into him. Let's listen to your question.
Are you putting what you're calling the alt-left and white supremacists on the same moral plane?
I'm not putting anybody on a moral plane. What I'm saying is this. You had a group on one side and you had a group on the other, and they came at each other with clubs, and it was vicious and it was horrible, and it was a horrible thing to watch. But there is another side. There was a group on this side, you can call them the left, you've just called them the left, that came violently attacking the other group. So you can say what you want, but that's the way it is.
You know, the president went on to say that there were fine people in both groups. And I think it was those comments that really just brought in a near universal backlash.
Yeah, I mean, and at the time, it felt like the oxygen was kind of sucked out of the room for a little bit there. I think the president started to defend some of those, it seemed, who were marching alongside the white supremacists, as you mentioned, saying there were fine people on both sides. And I think we should clarify, yes, there was violence on both sides. There were people marching with the counter protesters, who some of whom reacted violently as well. But the president, the fact that he seemed to be drawing some kind of moral equivalency between the two. And I have to say, it's a strange position to be in that room and to think that question even needed to be asked of the president of the United States. It's just not a question that you think will come up in a presidential press conference, impromptu or otherwise, to have to ask the president if he thinks that white supremacists and counter-protesters are on the same sort of moral level. But there the president was, blaming both sides. And you know, being there, I have to say, you could see the gravity of the moment, you know, on the faces of the White House staff. I think it wasn't just us reporters in the room who were trying to understand exactly what was going on here. You saw Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, Cohen, his, you know, two Jewish members of the president's team standing right next to him as he's making these comments. Everyone has now seen that probably those pictures of his chief of staff, General Kelly, who was actually standing not far from me, you know, in the end, just sort of with his head down, you know, sort of shaking his head, looking at the floor. There's some video of him where at moments he seems to even wince as the president is, you know, in some ways kind of really digging himself in here. And it seemed that they were all thinking, which is what we were thinking, which is what is going on here. And just one more point about how this all played out, which is that while we were told that the president was not going to take questions, he was clearly prepared. They had opened up the press pool. They had allowed additional reporters in. So there was sort of a larger group of us than there may normally be hanging out in the lobby of Trump Tower on any given day when the president is there in town. And he at one point, as you saw, pulled out a piece of paper in his pocket, folded up with his initial statement on it. So he was prepared to defend himself on this issue. You know, whether he was prepared to go as far as he did, who knows. And then after he seemed to be done taking questions, he actually came up to us again and started commenting even further. I mean, when asked questions about whether he was going to go visit Charlottesville, he started explaining, you know, a winery that he owns nearby. So this was not something that sort of really came out of nowhere. And that was the sense that we all got when this was finally over and done with.
Right. And made those surprised faces on those, yeah, for the staff members to look so surprised when it looked like the president planned to do this. Were they just not in the know?
We certainly have seen, it's amazing because the president, right, let's just take a step back. He's on this working vacation, and yet he has talked to the press more and seemed to be busier and more available and more willing to comment on things on his working vacation than he is when he's back here at the White House. And we've known from the way that some of these statements have played out that his staff has not been in the know, that this is the president off the cuff, the president being his own communications director here. We saw that last week with a lot of his comments about North Korea, and it seems that that was the case as well this week as the president was responding to this violence. And we saw almost immediately, I mean, even before the president made these remarks, even before this off-the-cuff press conference, the impact of the president's remarks were starting to play out when you saw some of, especially the business community, coming out and putting their foot down. And then we just saw this cascade of CEOs leaving the president's administration.
Absolutely. Just an avalanche of corporate America, real pillars of the business community, saying that they could not work with this president who ran on bringing his CEO sensibilities and relationships to Washington.
Yeah, this is the businessman president.
It was Ken Frazier, the only African-American member of the Manufacturing Council, was the first to say that he could not work with the president in that way anymore. And the president who struggled to name those neo-Nazis, name the KKK explicitly, named Frazier and went after him explicitly. But then, like you said, we just saw CEO after CEO saying that they just could not do it, convening a giant telephone conference where they debated whether it was worth,
amongst themselves, you know, mandatory phone call of the members of this panel.
What should the role be of the community? They want to advise him, but they just can't publicly work with him in this same way. We have just seen them respond, some real sort of celebrities and cultural figures respond, and like you said, members of his own party, Republicans, breaking sharply and quickly with the president this week.
Yeah, of course, it's not just the fallout from the business community, but I mean, these two, the president then coming out and trying to say that he's the one who's disbanding these panels and acting as if it was his decision. He came out and tweeted, you know, thank you all, I'm you know, going to cut these panels loose. But this was, they drove this. I mean, you had these CEOs coming out sort of one by one on one of the panels, the manufacturing panel, saying that they, you know, condemn the president's comments, they're leaving the group. And then this other elite group of top CEOs, these are big companies. You're talking about Pepsi, GE, IBM, all deciding together collectively they're going
to
disband, you know,
our
White House team.
To say like, oh, I'll replace them.
It's fine. I have other, you know, I have to
close ties to the business community. I can replace them. But then our White House team, you know, reported that These CEOs informed the president of this decision. They were going to disband. And moments later, boom, that tweet comes out with the president, you know, seeming to try to define this in his own terms. And then on the other side of this, politically, I mean, there just is, there's no way to spin this in any other terms than that this is really, it feels, been a tipping point in many ways. You are seeing members of the president's own party come out being very quick to establish where they stand on this issue, which again seems remarkable that you have so many politicians coming out and having to state clearly, you know, that they are against white supremacy, that they do not condone hate groups. And then this fine line that so many of them are having to walk, especially in leadership, where they're coming out and condemning and, you know, issuing these really harsh rebukes of the president's position, but they're not necessarily calling out the president himself. Now, we have seen a few members, a few prominent Republican members come out and do that, but a lot of others are walking a fine line here.
Right, and taking a lot of flack for it. I mean, you have Senate Leader Mitch McConnell not mentioning the president by name in his statement. Speaker Paul Ryan, not either. Really just some tweets early in the week. Neither one of these men going out on camera. On the other hand, you have someone like Bob Corker, another big figure there in the Senate, who's often very thoughtful, kind of soft-spoken up there.
Was rumored to be possibly in the Trump administration at points.
Right, he's been a real ally of this president. Yeah. He told reporters straight to the camera he felt this week like it was a reminder that this president does not have the stability or competence demonstrated sometimes to do this job and do it well. So clearly Republicans just unsure how to pick up the pieces here. And they're going to continue to get questions. I mean, they're going to get questions about whether his comments really have emboldened these hate groups, whether they've benefited from that at the polls, and whether their response has gone far enough or if there's something more they should do.
We'll be right back.
Hey there, it's Mara Schiavocampo from Good Morning America. Like so many people, I've struggled to find that perfect balance between health and happiness. Name a diet, I've probably tried it. Crazy workout plan, yep, I've done that too. But I learned it was my approach that was actually weighing me down. After losing 90 pounds, I discovered it's not just about reaching a healthy weight, it's about finding peace and freedom. I have a podcast called Motivated, focused on all things health and wellness. Join the conversation. Search Motivated on Apple Podcasts and subscribe today.
We are joined now by Congressman Andre Carson, the great Hoosier State from the 7th Congressional District of Indiana. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us on this very, very busy news week, shall we say.
What a tremendous honor. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, let's just sort of start with the big picture here, I guess. When you look back at this week and you think about the president's various responses, you think about the responses coming in from all across this country, I guess just how are you feeling? You know, it's been a pretty raw week. And given what you've heard from the president and from Americans, from your constituents, where's your head right now?
You know, it's interesting. I think that as so many people have pointed out, you know, condemning neo-Nazis and white supremacists really should be easy. You know, these ideologies are responsible for enslaving African ancestors in the U.S., killing millions of Jews in Europe. Hundreds of thousands of Americans have literally died fighting these ideologies. And you have entire segments of our population that are still struggling to overcome their legacy of discrimination and oppression. So our president took an oath to protect and defend the U.S., not to stand with his enemies. So I think his decision to stand up for these bigots and defend a domestic terrorist organization is disgraceful and, quite frankly, unpresidential.
Why do you think he says these things? Is he simply appealing, you think, to a portion of his base? Do you think he really believes these things? I mean, you're part of the leadership team of the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm curious, you know, if you can share with us a little bit of the conversations that maybe you all have been having. But is this simply what the president stands for, you think? Or is it just that he's, you know, too stubborn to admit that he initially maybe mishandled this situation? And so that's why we see sort of a doubling down on some of these positions?
One wonders if it's a combination of all of the above. I think that President Trump has a disturbing habit of standing up for the enemies of our country. He has continually defended Vladimir Putin and Russia, you know, despite abundant evidence that the Russians tampered in our elections. And yesterday, he defended people who, or a couple of days ago, he defended people who find common cause with Adolf Hitler and the Confederacy. And this is unprecedented amongst presidents. He needs to take a serious look at what it means to hold this office and find a better way to reflect the values of our country. So I think that if he's being Machiavellian, he's now become the emperor without clothes, and it's a sad sight. I think that his posturing and his provocations have fanned the flames of homophobia, xenophobia, Islamophobia, straight out bigotry and racism, discrimination against LGBT brothers and sisters. And to me, it's a sad state of affairs for our presidency and our country.
You know, you have a background working specifically in homeland security and counterterrorism, and have said that white supremacist organizations still pose a threat to security in the United States. Why do you think Congress hasn't done more on this issue? And do you think Republicans will make a point of tackling this topic when they come back in the fall?
I think, you know, I'm glad that you pointed that out. I made that comment several years ago, and I was met with great criticism. But I think a lot of members of Congress in general are just unaware. I would love to see my Republican colleagues speak out more boldly, and we're seeing some Republicans do so, but it hasn't been en masse. But I think given the environment and the fact that Donald Trump is dismantling the Republican Party literally minute by minute, my hope is that more of my Republican colleagues will feel emboldened to speak up and denounce who he is and who he has become and the embarrassment that he is to our country.
There have been a lot of conversations this week about Republicans' responses and response to the president's comments. You know, and you said that you were encouraged that members have taken a stand, but others have said that leadership hasn't gone far enough. Do you think that this has been a tipping point for them? How do you think they've handled it?
You know, I think in a very real sense, a lot of members of Congress represent districts that have Trump supporters, and these supporters can oftentimes make or break an election. And if you're living under the threat of a Donald Trump tweet or the Donald Trump apparatus putting together some effort to unseat you, or to raise up a challenger against you, that could cause a lot of concern for some of my Republican colleagues. But I think in this environment, Donald Trump has given them cover. And to speak boldly against him could actually secure an election, in my mind.
You think we've actually kind of tipped the scale in the other direction there, where instead of being afraid of the president's response, it's actually given them the opposite encouragement to go out and speaking out against the president now may be a benefit?
I think in some districts, yes. I think in other districts, no. I think he's still well-liked. Some of his strongest supporters feel like he's draining the swamp, not realizing that he is the crocodile in the swamp. But at the same time, he has a great deal of credibility, and people see hope in his message, and they feel as if he is speaking to them, which he is doing and has done. And so to live under that, even though personally a member of Congress may disagree with his philosophy and his agenda, to speak out too boldly against him could be political suicide for some members, and that's very unfortunate.
Now, one of the other things, of course, that has come out of all of this week, it's reignited this debate, right, over statues of Confederate generals. The march in Charlottesville began as a protest against taking down this statue of Robert E. Lee. And there are plenty of these statues, you know, not far from where we're sitting right now here in Washington. When you see one of these statues, what do you think? And what do you think when you hear the president defending them, as he did this week, as he tweeted, saying that he thinks it's sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart?
Well, while history and culture are important, I think we have to be mindful of people who are living today. You know, if you're an African-American child going to Robert E. Lee High School, you know, trying to learn in a school named for a man who fought to protect those who enslaved your family, that's pretty tough. Or even, you know, imagine going shopping going to church or a synagogue or a mosque and trying to build your community next to statues celebrating enslavement, oppression, discrimination of your people. And I think, you know, knowing that and defending those statues often, I think it has created those problems. Now, I understand that people want to remember their history. But that's why we have Civil War battlefields. That's why we teach history in schools. You know, it's time for these statues, flags, and other remembrances to go. So that's one of the reasons why I signed on as a co-sponsor of a resolution calling for the firing of, you know, the white nationalists in the White House. It's why we're working with the activist community in making sure we're bringing attention to these matters. And one of the blessings that I've seen, especially in my district, but across the country, is that we're seeing more white brothers and sisters engaged in this process, in this dialogue, and they're pushing back. And I think not only is it great optically, but I think it's good in a real way, in a tangible way, because it shows that at the end of the day, Americans stand up for the highest ideals, and we're about preserving our democracy. And that means that all of us have to be at the table. You know, non-theists, Muslims, Christians, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, white, black, Latino, Arab, American, we all have a part in preserving our democracy.
But another follow-up on that question, though, NPR did a poll at the beginning of this week that asked about that Confederate statue issue, if they should be removed or kept up as a historical symbol. And I was struck by the fact that regardless of age, most Americans said they should stay up. And even African Americans were split on the issue. What do you make of that?
There are some folks who feel as if we should never forget. And having these statues visibly present allows us to never forget our history and the struggle associated with that history. And then there's another school of thought that says that should be removed. I mean, they make the references to Germany, where you'll never see a statue of Hitler in Germany. And I think that there's validity there. I think if we are a pluralistic society, if we are a multi-ethnic society, a multiracial society, different philosophies, different schools of thought, the ability to express those thoughts and philosophies freely, having the ability to dissent freely, to critique our own government freely, I think it's important that we do not idolize, nor should we mythologize, or even sanitize or pasteurize people who were not only sexist but racist. You know, the Founding Fathers were very complicated. They were sexist, certainly. They were slaveholders. They were visionary in setting up three separate but equal branches of government. But I think we have to be careful not to mythologize our Founding Fathers, because in their frailty, in their humanity, in their flaws, they should serve as an example for other leaders what not to do. And I think Donald Trump, who tends to idolize or promote the Founding Fathers without balance, I think he should take heed and pay attention or become a student of history.
And before we let you go, sir, I have to get your reaction to some news that just came in here that the president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, is leaving the administration. He's resigned. Wondering, so if you think that this is a result of the president's comments this week, if you think that that's linked at all to that, and what do you think his departure may mean for the White House's relationship with Congress? Does Steve Bannon being out of the White House, you think, does that help this president maybe recover in some way?
Well, I find it pretty interesting that Steve Bannon was hired despite the criticism about white nationalist propaganda that he had been publishing at Breitbart. Yet, he was removed when he went on record calling white nationalists losers, you know, fringe and a collection of clowns. So I think it's clear that he wanted someone who would appeal to those extremists and help him secure their votes and support. But should he be applauded for removing him? No. He should have never been hired in the first place. So it was disgraceful to hire someone who said and published the terrible things he did. Long overdue. This is long overdue.
Congressman, thank you so much for joining us.
What an honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary Alice, let's pick up right there, actually, where we left with Congressman Carson, because this is all just breaking right now. The president's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, a lightning rod of a figure within this administration, is now resigning at the end of this very volatile week. And he's someone who's, you know, been accused of playing a role here in the way that the president has handled the violence in Virginia.
Right. Democrats have called Steve Bannon a white supremacist since day one. They're celebrating today. But this is someone who was credited with a lot of the president's campaign success. And we know that the president doesn't exactly love when someone else gets any credit. Earlier this week, he tried to distance that idea. He said, oh, we got a lot done in the campaign before Steve Bannon came on board. But people have asked from the beginning, how much does someone like this influence the president's thinking? Was he the architect of that many sides comment earlier on, trying to not necessarily place definite blame on one side or the other? This is someone that people say is directly involved with that white nationalist sort of fervor that we've seen grow in this country. And people have said his role in the president's year could have really impacted some of his thinking.
He's really in many ways embodied that voice of defiant populism within this administration. He's known as a ardent nationalist. He's the former head of Breitbart News. He's raised a lot of eyebrows up on Capitol Hill, certainly, and within a lot of people within this administration. Look, I think we've reported for months the back and forth, the sort of feuds between, you know, Bannon and Jared, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Steve Bannon's been on the rocks for, it seems, for a while. There have been rumors that the president was going to sort of cut him loose, and then he gave this rather explosive interview where he seemed to question some of the president's positions earlier this week, and that just seems to have maybe been the nail in the coffin. But some people are questioning if the president needed to take some action following this week, and maybe that was letting Bannon go or Bannon resigning. But it just goes to show, when you look at, you know, I think I've almost lost count. I'm out of fingers of how many strategists, aides, people close to the president have left this administration. Even this month, I mean, we've seen communications directors, chief of staff turnover, and now chief strategist.
Right, who's left?
Who's left?
I mean, who's there? And like, if he's not
well,
in
right
there,
now, they're all up in New Jersey.
Right. Who's there? But I think you're right. I'm not convinced that there will be much love lost for Steve Bannon on Capitol Hill. You've had plenty of Republicans there in this core leadership feeling like they were at odds with him from the beginning.
You know, he did not sit well with the establishment Republicans.
No, Breitbart used to argue that they were part of the problem. You know, rumored to call Speaker Ryan the enemy in the past. So this is a guy who has been controversial, to say the least, since day one. And it will be very interesting to see if, in fact, Republicans are sort of glad to see him go. But is there a core part of his base, some other conservatives that feel like they lost a voice now?
Yeah, and who then is the link going forward between Congress and the White House? I mean, you mentioned when they come back in 2 weeks, they've got quite a to-do list. They have a lot of things they need to do. They've lost Reince Priebus as a connection. Those conservatives who've been working with Steve Bannon is their link to the White House. Now he's out. What does this mean for the president going forward? You know what? Let's leave those questions next week. We'll let John Carl and Rick Klein answer all those ones. Mary Alice, this has been a lot of fun.
Thanks, Mary.
We'll talk to you guys next week, and we hope that that John Carl and Rick Klein are listening in on their vacations.
They're jealous. They're jealous of how much fun we're having. They wish they were here.
We hope they're having a stiff drink. Maybe they can save one for us, because after a week like this, I think we're going to need it.
Are you ready for a glass of wine?
I am. We'll see you guys later.